The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Hello, this is Margaret Dixon on Page Turners at 89.7 WTBR-FM Pittsfield Radio. We are continuing to read The House on the Borderland by William Hope Hodgson. And not going to lie, today's episode is going to get extra weird. That's really the only way I know to describe it, without spoiling it. So let's see if you agree with me. The Trap in the Great Cellar. I suppose I must have swooned, for the next thing I remember, I opened my eyes and all was dusk. I was lying on my back with one leg doubled under the other, and Pepper was licking my ears. I felt horribly stiff, and my leg was numb from the knee downwards. For a few minutes, I lay thus in a dazed condition. Then slowly, I struggled to a sitting position and looked about me. It had stopped raining, but the trees still dripped dismally. From the pit came a continuous murmur of running water. I felt cold and shivery. My clothes were sodden, and I ached all over. Very slowly, the life came back into my numbed leg, and, after a little, I essayed to stand up. This I managed at the second attempt, but I was very tottery and peculiarly weak. It seemed to me that I was going to be ill, and I made shift to stumble my way towards the house. My steps were erratic and my head confused. At each step that I took, sharp pains shot through my limbs. I had gone perhaps some 30 paces when a cry from Pepper drew my attention, and I turned stiffly towards him. The old dog was trying to follow me but could come no further, owing to the rope with which I had hauled him up being still tied round his body, the other end not having been unfastened from the tree. For a moment I fumbled with the knots weakly, but they were wet and hard, and I could do nothing. Then I remembered my knife, and in a minute the rope was cut. How I reached the house, I scarcely know, and of the days that followed, I remember still less. Of one thing I am certain, that had it not been for my sister's untiring love and nursing, I would not have been writing at this moment. When I recovered my senses, it was to find that I had been in bed for nearly 2 weeks. Yet another week passed before I was strong enough to totter out into the gardens. Even then, I was not able to walk so far as the pit. I would have liked to ask my sister how high the water had risen, but I felt it was wiser not to mention the subject to her. Indeed, since then, I have made a rule never to speak to her about the strange things that happen in this great old house. It was not until a couple of days later that I managed to get across to the pit. There I found that, in my few weeks' absence, there had been wrought a wondrous change. Instead of the three-parts-filled ravine, I looked out upon a great lake whose placid surface reflected the light coldly. The water had risen to within half a dozen feet of the pit edge. Only in one part was the lake disturbed, and that was above the place where, far down under the silent waters, yawned the entrance to the vast underground pit. Here there was a continuous bubbling, and occasionally a curious sort of sobbing gurgle would find its way up from the depth. Beyond these, there was nothing to tell of the things that were hidden beneath. As I stood there, it came to me how wonderfully things had worked out. The entrance to the place whence the swine creatures had come was sealed up, by a power that made me feel there was nothing more to fear from them. And yet, with the feeling, there was a sensation that now I should never learn anything further of the place from which those dreadful things had come. It was completely shut off and concealed from human curiosity forever. Strange, in the knowledge of that underground hellhole, how apposite has been the naming of the pit. One wonders how it originated and when. Naturally, one concludes that the shape and depth of the ravine would suggest the name Pit. Yet, is it not possible that it has, all along, held a deeper significance, a hint, Could one but have guessed of the greater, more stupendous pit that lies far down in the earth, beneath this old house, under this house? Even now the idea is strange and terrible to me, for I have proved beyond doubt that the pit yawns right below the house, which is evidently supported somewhere above the center of it, upon a tremendous arched roof of solid rock. It happened in this wise that, having occasion to go down to the cellars, the thought occurred to me to pay a visit to the great vault where the trap is situated, and see whether everything was as I had left it. Reaching the place, I walked slowly up the center until I came to the trap. There it was, with the stones piled upon it, just as I had seen it last. I had a lantern with me, and the idea came to me that now would be a good time to investigate whatever lay beneath the great oak slab. Placing the lantern on the floor, I tumbled the stones off the trap and, grasping the ring, pulled the door open. As I did so, the cellar became filled with the sound of a murmurous thunder that rose from far below. At the same time, a damp wind blew up into my face, bringing with it a load of fine spray. Therewith, I dropped the trap hurriedly with a half-frightened feeling of wonder. For a moment, I stood puzzled. I was not particularly afraid. The haunting fear of the swine things had left me long ago, but I was certainly nervous and astonished. Then a sudden thought possessed me, and I raised the ponderous door with a feeling of excitement. Leaving it standing upon its end, I seized the lantern and, kneeling down, thrust it into the opening. As I did so, the moist wind and spray drove in my eyes, making me unable to see for a few moments. Even when my eyes were clear, I could distinguish nothing below me save darkness and whirling spray. Seeing that it was useless to expect to make out anything with the light so high, I felt in my pockets for a piece of twine with which to lower it further into the opening. Even as I fumbled, the lantern slipped from my fingers and hurtled down into the darkness. For a brief instant, I watched its fall and saw the light shine on a tumult of white foam some 80 or 100 feet below me. Then it was gone. My sudden surmise was correct, and now I knew the cause of the wet and noise. The great cellar was connected with the pit by means of the trap which opened right above it, and the moisture was the spray rising from the water falling into the depths. In an instant, I had an explanation of certain things that had hitherto puzzled me. Now I could understand why the noises on the first night of the invasion had seemed to rise directly from under my feet, and the chuckle that had sounded when I first opened the trap. Evidently, some of the swine things must have been right beneath me. Another thought struck me. Were the creatures all drowned? Would they drown? I remembered how unable I had been to find any traces to show that my shooting had been really fatal. Had they life as we understand life, or were they ghouls? These thoughts flashed through my brain as I stood in the dark, searching my pockets for matches. I had the box in my hand now, and striking a light, I stepped to the trap door and closed it. Then I piled the stones back upon it, after which I made my way out from the cellars. And so, I suppose, the water goes on, thundering down into that bottomless hell pit. Sometimes I have an inexplicable desire to go down into the great cellar, open the trap, and gaze into the impenetrable, spray-damp darkness. At times, the desire becomes almost overpowering in its intensity. It is not mere curiosity that prompts me, but more as though some unexplained influence were at work. Still, I never go, and intend to fight down the strange longing and crush it, even as I would the unholy thought of self-destruction. This idea of some intangible force being exerted may seem reasonless, yet my instinct warns me that it is not so. In these things, reason seems to me less to be trusted than instinct. One thought there is, in closing, that impresses itself upon me with ever-growing insistence. It is that I live in a very strange house, a very awful house, and I have begun to wonder whether I am doing wisely in staying here. Yet, if I left, where could I go and still obtain the solitude and the sense of her presence that alone makes my old life bearable? Editor's note. An apparently unmeaning interpolation. I can find no previous reference in the manuscript to this matter. It becomes clear, however, in the light of succeeding incidents. All right, well, that was certainly strange, and it's only going to get stranger. But first, a message from our sponsor.
This is Pittsfield Community Radio, 89.7 WTBR-FM Pittsfield, 88.1 WSBR Lee.
Support for WTBR comes from Greylock Federal Credit Union, proud to support high school arts and sports programs to help our community thrive. Greylock Federal, with locations throughout the Berkshires and online at greylock.org.
And from UCP of Western Massachusetts. UCP of Western Mass is hiring full and part-time opportunities to provide a life without limits for people with disabilities. For more information, ucpwma.org/jobs.
Still paying for that monthly gym membership? How about that streaming service you never watch? Why not support WTBR-FM instead? For just $8.97 a month, you could show your support for our community radio station today. Go to WTBRFM.com and click donate. It's as easy as that. We need to support this station to keep it on the air, and every little bit helps. WTBR-FM, for the love of radio.
The Pittsfield Health Department is hosting monthly wellness clinics available to the community at the Christian Center, Senior Center, Epworth Arms, Capitol Square, and South Congregational Church. Vital sign checks, medication reviews, and health assessments are offered by the public health nurse. Our social worker will be there with information of available resources as well. For more information about these clinics, please contact us at 413-499-9411.
Support for this public service announcement comes from Berkshire Community College and Park Square Productions.
Larry Kratka here on WTBR, and I want to tell you about my show, Sweet Country Music. Now, every Sunday morning from 11 a.m. until noon, I'll play some of the best classic country artists like Merle Haggard, Dolly Parton, Johnny Cash, Patsy Cline, and many more. I'll play nothing before 2008. Please join me Sunday mornings at 11 a.m. for the next edition of Sweet Country Music here on 89.7 WTBR-FM for the love of radio.
Support for WTBR comes from Berkshire Community College. Free community college for any Massachusetts resident without a bachelor's degree at BCC. Find out more at berkshirecc.edu. And from Sundrini Awnings and Home Improvement, providing awnings and canopies in Western Mass. Retractable awnings, retractable screens, gutter and gutter protection systems, commercial awnings and screen rooms, customized solutions available. Online at sondrini.com.
Radio for people who used to love radio. Welcome back, WTBR.
And we're back. For those just tuning in, this is Margaret Dixon on Page Turners, reading The House on the Borderland by William Hope Hodgson. Last we checked, our protagonist was checking out his incredibly creepy basement, and he's probably going to find more creepy stuff as the story goes on, to say the least. Let's find out what. The Sea of Sleep. For a considerable period after the last incident, which I've narrated in my diary, I had serious thoughts of leaving this house, and might have done so, but for the great and wonderful thing of which I am about to write. How well I was advised in my heart when I stayed on here, spite of those visions and sights of unknown and unexplainable things. For, had I not stayed, then I had not again seen the face of her I loved. Yes, though few know it, none now save my sister Mary, I have loved, and ah, me, lost. I would write down the story of those sweet old days, but it would be like the tearing of old wounds. Yet, after that which has happened, what need have I to care? For she has come to me out of the unknown. Strangely, she warned me. Warned me passionately against this house, begged me to leave it, but admitted, when I questioned her, that she could not have come to me had I been elsewhere. Yet in spite of this, still she warned me, earnestly, telling me that it was a place long ago given over to evil, and under the power of grim laws of which none here have knowledge. And I just asked her again whether she would come to me elsewhere, and she could only stand silent. It was thus that I came to the place of the Sea of Sleep, so she termed it in her dear speech with me. I had stayed up in my study reading and must have dozed over the book. Suddenly I awoke and sat upright with a start. For a moment I looked round with a puzzled sense of something unusual. There was a misty look about the room, giving a curious softness to each table and chair and furnishing. Gradually the mistiness increased, growing, as it were, out of nothing. Then, slowly, a soft white light began to glow in the room. The flames of the candles shone through it palely. I looked from side to side and found that I could still see each piece of furniture, but in a strangely unreal way, more as though the ghost of each table and chair had taken the place of the solid article. Gradually, as I looked, I saw them fade and fade until slowly they resolved into nothingness. Now I looked again at the candles. They shone wanly, and even as I watched, grew more unreal and so vanished. The room was filled now with a soft yet luminous white twilight, like a gentle mist of light. Beyond this, I could see nothing. Even the walls had vanished. Presently, I became conscious that a faint, continuous sound pulsed through the silence that wrapped me. I listened intently. It grew more distinct until it appeared to me that I harked to the breathings of some great sea. I cannot tell how long a space passed thus, but after a while it seemed that I could see through the mistiness, and slowly I became aware that I was standing upon the shore of an immense and silent sea. This shore was smooth and long, vanishing to right and left of me in extreme distances. In front swam a still immensity of sleeping ocean. At times it seemed to me that I caught a faint glimmer of light under its surface, but of this I could not be sure. Behind me rose up to an extraordinary height gaunt black cliffs. Overhead the sky was of a uniform cold gray color, the whole place being lit by a stupendous globe of pale fire that swam a little above the far horizons and shed a foam-like light above the quiet waters. Beyond the gentle murmur of the sea, an intense stillness prevailed. For a long while I stayed there, looking out across its strangeness. Then, as I stared, it seemed that a bubble of white foam floated up out of the depths, and then, even now, I know not how it was, I was looking upon, nay, looking into the face of her. Aye, into her face, into her soul, and she looked back at me with such a commingling of joy and sadness that I ran towards her blindly, crying strangely to her in a very agony of remembrance, of terror, of hope to come to me. Yet, spite of my crying, she stayed out there upon the sea and only shook her head sorrowfully. But in her eyes was the old earth-light of tenderness that I had come to know before all things ere we were parted. At her perverseness I grew desperate and essayed to wade out to her. Yet, though I would, I could not. Something, some invisible barrier, held me back, and I was fain to stay where I was and cry out to her in the fullness of my soul, "Oh, my darling," but could say no more for very intensity. And at that she came over swiftly and touched me, and it was as though heaven had opened. Yet when I reached out my hands to her, she put me from her with tenderly stern hands, and I was abashed. Note. Here the writing becomes undecipherable, owing to the damaged condition of this part of the manuscript. Below I print such fragments as are legible. The fragments, the legible portions of the mutilated leaves. Through tears, noise of eternity in my ears, we parted. She whom I love, oh my God! I was a great time dazed, and then I was alone in the blackness of the night. I knew that I journeyed back once more to the known universe. Presently I emerged from that enormous darkness. I had come among the stars, vast time, the sun far and remote. I entered into the gulf that separates our system from the outer suns. As I sped across the dividing dark, I watched steadily the ever-growing brightness and size of our sun. Once I glanced back to the stars and saw them shift, as it were, in my wake, against the mighty background of night, so vast was the speed of my passing spirit. I drew nigher to our system, and now I could see the shine of Jupiter. Later I distinguished the cold blue gleam of the Earthlight. I had a moment of bewilderment. All about the sun there seemed to be bright objects moving in rapid orbits. Inward, nigh to the savage glory of the sun, there circled two darting points of light, and further off there flew a blue shining speck that I knew to be the Earth. It circled the sun in a space that seemed to be no more than an Earth minute. Nearer, with great speed, I saw the radiances of Jupiter and Saturn spinning with incredible swiftness in huge orbits. And ever I drew more nigh and looked out upon the strange sight, the visible circling of the planets about the mother sun. It was as though time had been annihilated for me, so that a year was no more to my unfleshed spirit than is a moment to an earthbound soul. The speed of the planets appeared to increase, and presently I was watching the sun, all ringed about with hair-like circles of different colored fire, the paths of the planets hurtling at mighty speed about the central flame. The sun grew vast as though it leapt to meet me. And now I was within the circling of the outer planets and flitting swiftly towards a place where the Earth, glimmering through the blue splendor of its orbit, as though a fiery mist circled the sun at a monstrous speed. Note: the severest scrutiny has not enabled me to decipher more of the damaged portions of the manuscript. It commences to be legible again with a chapter entitled The Noise in the Night. The Noise in the Night. And now I come to the strangest of all the strange happenings that have befallen me in this house of mysteries. It occurred quite lately, within the month, and I have little doubt but that what I saw was, in reality, the end of all things. However, to my story. I do not know how it is, but up to the present, I have never been able to write these things down directly after they happened. It is as though I have to wait a time, recovering my just balance and digesting, as it were, the things I have heard or seen. No doubt this is as it should be, for by waiting I see the incidents more truly and write of them in a calmer and more judicial frame of mind. This, by the way. It is now the end of November. My story relates to what happened in the first week of the month. It was night, about 11 o'clock. Pepper and I kept one another company in the study, that great old room of mine where I read and work. I was reading, curiously enough, the Bible. I have begun, in these later days, to take a growing interest in that great and ancient book. Suddenly, a distinct tremor shook the house, and there came a faint and distant whirring buzz that grew rapidly into a far, muffled screaming. It reminded me in a strange, gigantic way of the noise that a clock makes when the catch is released and it is allowed to run down. The sound appeared to come from some remote height, somewhere up in the night. There was no repetition of the shock. I looked across at Pepper. He was sleeping peacefully. Gradually, the whirring noise decreased and there came a long silence. All at once, a glow lit up the end window, which protrudes far out from the side of the house, so that, from it, one may look both east and west. I felt puzzled, and after a moment's hesitation, walked across the room and pulled aside the blind. As I did so, I saw the sun rise from behind the horizon. It rose with a steady, perceptible movement. I could see it travel upwards. In a minute, it seemed, it had reached the tops of the trees through which I had watched it. Up, up. It was broad daylight now. Behind me, I was conscious of a sharp, mosquito-like buzzing. I glanced around and knew that it came from the clock. Even as I looked, it marked off an hour. The minute hand was moving round the dial faster than an ordinary second hand. The hour hand moved quickly from space to space. I had a numb sense of astonishment. A moment later, so it seemed, the two candles went out almost together. I turned swiftly back to the window, for I had seen the shadow of the window frames traveling along the floor towards me, as though a great lamp had been carried up past the window. I saw now that the sun had risen high into the heavens and was still visibly moving. It passed above the house with an extraordinary sailing kind of motion. As the window came into shadow, I saw another extraordinary thing. The fine weather clouds were not passing easily across the sky. They were scampering as though 100-mile-an-hour wind blew. As they passed, they changed their shapes 1,000 times a minute, as though writhing with a strange life. And so were gone, and presently others came and whisked away likewise. To the west I saw the sun drop with an incredible smooth, swift motion. Eastward the shadows of every seen thing crept towards the coming grayness. And the movement of the shadows was visible to me, a stealthy, writhing creep of the shadows of the wind-stirred trees. It was a strange sight. Quickly the room began to darken. The sun slid down to the horizon and seemed, as it were, to disappear from my sight, almost with a jerk. Through the grayness of the swift evening, I saw the silver crescent of the moon falling out of the southern sky towards the west. The evening seemed to merge into an almost instant night. Above me, the many constellations passed in a strange, noiseless circling westwards. The moon fell through that last 1,000 fathoms of the night gulf, and there was only the starlight. About this time, the buzzing in the corner ceased, telling me that the clock had run down. A few minutes passed, and I saw the eastward sky lighten. A gray, sullen morning spread through all the darkness and hid the march of the stars. Overhead there moved, with a heavy, everlasting rolling, a vast, seamless sky of gray clouds, a cloud sky that would have seemed motionless through all the length of an ordinary Earth day. The sun was hidden from me, but from moment to moment the world would brighten and darken beneath waves of subtle light and shadow. The light shifted ever westward, and the night fell upon the earth. A vast rain seemed to come with it, and a wind of a most extraordinary loudness, as though the howling of a night-long gale were packed into the space of no more than a minute. This noise passed almost immediately, and the clouds broke, so that once more I could see the sky. The stars were flying westward with astonishing speed. It came to me now, for the first time, that though the noise of the wind had passed, yet a constant blurred sound was in my ears. Now that I noticed it, I was aware that it had been with me all the time. It was the world noise. And then, even as I grasped at so much comprehension, there came the eastward light. No more than a few heartbeats, and the sun rose swiftly. Through the trees I saw it, and then it was above the trees. Up, up it soared, and all the world was light. It passed with a swift, steady swing to its highest altitude, and fell thence westward. I saw the day roll visibly over my head. A few light clouds flittered northward and vanished. The sun went down with one swift, clear plunge, and there was, about me, for a few seconds, the darker growing gray of the gloaming. Southward and westward the moon was sinking rapidly. The night had come already. A minute, it seemed, and the moon fell those remaining fathoms of dark sky. Another minute or so, and the eastward sky glowed with the coming dawn. The sun leapt up upon me with a frightening abruptness and soared ever more swiftly towards the zenith. Then suddenly a fresh thing came to my sight. A black thundercloud rushed up out of the south and seemed to leap all the arc of sky in a single instant. As it came, I saw that its advancing edge flapped like a monstrous black cloth in the heaven, twirling and undulating rapidly with a horrid suggestiveness. In an instant, all the air was full of rain, and 100 lightning flashes seemed to flood downwards, as it were in one great shower. In the same second of time, the world noise was drowned in the roar of the wind, and then my ears ached under the stunning impact of the thunder. And in the midst of the storm, the night came, and then, within the space of another minute, the storm had passed, and there was only the constant blur of the world noise on my hearing. Overhead, the stars were sliding quickly westward, and something, mayhaps the particular speed to which they had attained, brought home to me, for the first time, a keen realization of the knowledge that it was the world that revolved. I seemed to see suddenly the world, a vast, dark mass, revolving visibly against the stars. The dawn and the sun seemed to come together, so greatly had the speed of the world revolution increased. The sun drove up in one long, steady curve, past its highest point, and swept down into the western sky and disappeared. I was scarcely conscious of evening, so brief was it. Then I was watching the flying constellations and the westward hastening moon. In but a space of seconds, so it seemed, it was sliding swiftly downward and through the night blue, and then was gone. And almost directly came the morning. And now there seemed to come a strange acceleration. The sun made one clean, clear sweep through the sky and disappeared behind the westward horizon, and the night came and went with a like haste. As the succeeding day opened and closed upon the world, I was aware of a sweat of snow suddenly upon the earth. The night came, and almost immediately the day. In the brief leap of the sun, I saw the snow had vanished, and then once more it was night. Thus matters were, and even after the many incredible things that I have seen, I experienced, all the time, a most profound awe. To see the sun rise and set within a space of time to be measured by seconds, to watch, after a little, the moon leap, a pale and ever-growing orb, up into the night sky and glide with a strange swiftness through the vast arc of blue, and presently to see the sun follow, springing out of the eastern sky as though in chase, and then again the night with the swift and ghostly passing of starry constellations, was all too much to view believingly. Yet so it was, the day slipping from dawn to dusk and the night sliding swiftly into day, ever rapidly and more rapidly. The last three passages of the sun had shown me a snow-covered earth, which at night had seemed, for a few seconds, incredibly weird under the fast-shifting light of the soaring and falling moon. Now, however, for a little space, the sky was hidden by a sea of swaying, leaden-white clouds, which lightened and blackened alternately with the passage of day and night. The clouds rippled and vanished, and there was once more before me the vision of the swiftly leaping sun and nights that came and went like shadows. Faster and faster spun the world, and now each day and night was completed within the space of but a few seconds, and still the speed increased. It was a little later that I noticed that the sun had begun to have the suspicion of a trail of fire behind it. This was due, evidently, to the speed at which it apparently traversed the heavens. And as the days sped, each one quicker than the last, the sun began to assume the appearance of a vast flaming comet, flaring across the sky at short periodic intervals. At night, the moon presented, with much greater truth, a comet-like aspect, a pale and singularly clear, fast-traveling shape of fire, trailing streaks of cold flame. The stars showed now merely as fine hairs of fire against the dark. Once I turned from the window and glanced at Pepper. In the flash of a day, I saw they slept quietly, and I moved once more to my watching. The sun was now bursting up from the eastern horizon like a stupendous rocket, seeming to occupy no more than a second or two in hurling from east to west. I could no longer perceive the passage of clouds across the sky, which seemed to have darkened somewhat. The brief nights appeared to have lost the proper darkness of night, so that the hair-like fire of the flying stars showed but dimly. As the speed increased, the sun began to sway very slowly in the sky, from south to north, and then slowly again from north to south. So, amid a strange confusion of mind, the hours passed. All this while had Pepper slept. Presently, feeling lonely and distraught, I called to him softly, but he took no notice. Again I called, raising my voice slightly. Still he moved not. I walked over to where he lay and touched him with my foot to rouse him. At the action, gentle though it was, he fell to pieces. That is what happened. He literally and actually crumbled into a moldering heap of bones and dust. For the space of perhaps a minute, I stared down at the shapeless heap that had once been Pepper. I stood feeling stunned. "What can have happened?" I asked myself, not at once grasping the grim significance of that little pile of ash. Then, as I stirred the heap with my foot, it occurred to me that this could only happen in a great space of time. Years and years. Outside, the weaving, fluttering light held the world. Inside, I stood, trying to understand what it meant. What that little pile of dust and dry bones on the carpet meant. But I could not think coherently. I glanced away round the room, and now, for the first time, noticed how dusty and old the place looked. Dust and dirt everywhere, piled in little heaps in the corners, and spread about upon the furniture. The very carpet itself was invisible beneath a coating of the same all-pervading material. As I walked, little clouds of the stuff rose up from under my footsteps and assailed my nostrils with a dry, bitter odor that made me wheeze huskily. Suddenly, as my glance fell upon Pepper's remains, I stood still and gave voice to my confusion, questioning aloud whether the years were indeed passing, whether this which I had taken to be a form of vision was in truth a reality. I paused. A new thought had struck me, quickly but with steps which, for the first time I noticed, tottered. I went across the room to the great pier glass and looked in. It was too covered with grime to give back any reflection, and with trembling hands I began to rub off the dirt. Presently I could see myself. The thought that had come to me was confirmed. Instead of the great, hale man who scarcely looked 50, I was looking at a bent, decrepit man whose shoulders stooped and whose face was wrinkled with the years of a century. The hair, which a few short hours ago had been nearly coal black, was now silvery white. Only the eyes were bright. Gradually, I traced in that ancient man a faint resemblance to myself of other days. I turned away and tottered to the window. I knew now that I was old, and the knowledge seemed to confirm my trembling walk. For a little space, I stared moodily out into the blurred vista of changeful landscape. Even in that short time, a year passed, and with a petulant gesture, I left the window. As I did so, I noticed that my hand shook with the palsy of old age, and a short sob choked its way through my lips. For a little while, I paced tremulously between the window and the table, my gaze wandering hither and thither uneasily. How dilapidated the room was. Everywhere lay the thick dust, thick, sleepy, and black. The fender was a shape of rust. The chains that held the brass clock weights had rusted through long ago, and now the weights lay on the floor beneath, themselves two cones of verdigris. As I glanced about, it seemed to me that I could see the very furniture of the room rotting and decaying before my eyes. Nor was this fancy on my part, for all at once the bookshelf, along with the side wall, collapsed with a cracking and rending of rotten wood, precipitating its contents upon the floor and filling the room with a smother of dusty atoms. How tired I felt! As I walked, it seemed that I could hear my dry joints creak and crack at every step. I wondered about my sister. Was she dead as well as Pepper? All had happened so quickly and suddenly. This must be indeed the beginning of the end of all things. It occurred to me to go to look for her, but I felt too weary. And then she had been so strange about these happenings of late. Of late! I repeated the words and laughed feebly, mirthlessly, as the realization was borne upon me that I spoke of a time half a century gone. Half a century. It might have been twice as long. I moved slowly to the window and looked out once more across the world. I can best describe the passage of day and night at this period as a sort of gigantic, ponderous flicker. Moment by moment, the acceleration of time continued, so that at nights now I saw the moon only as a swaying trail of palish fire that varied from a mere line of light to a nebulous path, and then dwindled again, disappearing periodically. The flicker of the days and nights quickened. The days had grown perceptibly darker, and a strange quality of dusk lay, as it were, in the atmosphere. The nights were so much lighter that the stars were scarcely to be seen, saving here and there an occasional hair-like line of fire that seemed to sway a little with the moon. Quicker and ever quicker ran the flicker of day and night, and suddenly, it seemed, I was aware that the flicker had died out, and instead there reigned a comparatively steady light, which was shed upon all the world from an eternal river of flame that swung up and down, north and south, in stupendous, mighty swings. The sky was now grown very much darker, and there was in the blue of it a heavy gloom, as though a vast blackness peered through it upon the earth. Yet there was in it also a strange and awful clearness and emptiness. Periodically I had glimpses of a ghostly track of fire that swayed thin and darkly towards the sunstream, vanished and reappeared. It was the scarcely visible moonstream. Looking out at the landscape, I was conscious again of a blurring sort of flitter that came either from the light of the ponderous swinging sunstream or was the result of the incredibly rapid changes of the earth's surface. And every few moments, so it seemed, the snow would lie suddenly upon the world and vanish as abruptly, as though an invisible giant flitted a white sheaf off and on the earth. Time fled, and the weariness that was mine grew insupportable. I turned from the window and walked once across the room, the heavy dust deadening the sound of my footsteps. Each step that I took seemed a greater effort than the one before. An intolerable ache knew me in every joint and limb as I trod my way with a weary uncertainty. By the opposite wall I came to a weak pause and wondered dimly what was my intent. I looked to my left and saw my old chair. The thought of sitting in it brought a faint sense of comfort to my bewildered wretchedness. Yet, because I was so weary and old and tired, I would scarcely brace my mind to do anything but stand and wish myself past those few yards. I rocked as I stood. The floor even seemed a place for rest, but the dust lay so thick and sleepy and black. I turned with a great effort of will and made towards my chair. I reached it with a groan of thankfulness. I sat down. Everything about me appeared to be growing dim. It was all so strange and unthought of. Last night I was a comparatively strong, though elderly, man, and now, only a few hours later, I looked at the little dust heap that had once been Pepper. Hours! And I laughed a feeble, bitter laugh, a shrill, cackling laugh that shocked my dimming senses. For a while I must have dozed. Then I opened my eyes with a start. Somewhere across the room there had been a muffled noise of something falling. I looked and saw vaguely a cloud of dust hovering above a pile of debris. Near the door something else tumbled with a crash. It was one of the cupboards. But I was tired and took little notice. I closed my eyes and sat there in a state of drowsy semi-unconsciousness. Once or twice, as though coming through thick mists, I heard noises faintly. And then I must have slept. Well, that certainly was trippy, to say the least. I'm not sure how it could get much weirder, but, you know, it's probably going to get weirder. Just as a warning. But I bet some of you out there like it, and I enjoy it too. So, as usual, this was Page Turners by Margaret Dixon. I enjoyed reading to you, and I hope you enjoyed listening. I'll see you next time.